Shoes.
Recorded live.
Hi, this is Mark Giuliano, and welcome to the next class of entrepreneurship and business planning. One thing, by the way, if you're listening to this recording, it's very possible there's been an advertisement inserted in it. I debated whether or not to put ads in this, and I felt, hey, we're talking about business and entrepreneurship and marketing and things like that, so somebody can make some money off of this by inserting ads. Some companies, for example, TalkShoe, where I work, is going to be inserting ads, and they can make some money as a startup company. So, you know, what the heck? It sort of shows an entrepreneurial spirit and a new way to make money using podcasting. Anyway, a couple things before I get started. If this is the first time that you've listened to a recording of mine, please go ahead and listen to the first episode now. There's a lot of introductory information about the course, about my background, about what we're going to cover, about websites, companion websites, things like that. And I should mention now, one thing you might want to do is go to www.talkshoe.com/Professor Giuliano, J-U-L-I-A-N-O, and there are some companion materials, including PowerPoint slides, which go along with the lectures. Okay, so today we're going to talk about funding and financing a company, basically how to get money in order to fund your venture. And money is, of course, critical. It turns out more than 80% of businesses fail fundamentally because they run out of money, not because they have a bad idea, not because they don't have customers, but because they're doing pretty well and they just run out of funds and don't have a source for additional funds. Now, before getting started with talking specifically about raising money, I want to talk about stock. And the reason for that is that stock is critical in terms of raising money. I'm sure a lot of you have purchased stock on the stock market. It's really kind of a little different than it is in a startup company. I mean, it's the same and it's different. You know, stock is stock, but the way you look at it is different. So in a company on the stock market, you buy their shares and they're $20 a share, and you obviously hope you get $30 a share. But it's not really that simple. It turns out, let's say a company were to sell for $1 billion and you own so many shares, you actually really own some percentage of that company, so you're entitled to some percentage of what they're purchased for. Now you're thinking more like an entrepreneur and more like a startup company. So stock basically is a measure of how many shares you own in the company, which more importantly is a measure of what percentage of the company you own. So a company, for example, can have 100 shares in the entire company. A company can have 1 million, 10 million, a billion. It doesn't matter how many shares you have. Total, what matters is your percentage. So we're going to, you know, use round numbers here. Let's say you have 1 million shares. We're going to be a really nice big company someday, so we want to have lots of shares to sell to people. Let's say I have 1 million shares, and total in the entire company, I own 500,000 of those shares as the founder, so I own 50% of the company. I have an employee who I want to hire who's a real hotshot, and I want to give him a piece of the company, so maybe I give him 10% of the company, so I would give him 100,000 shares, and so on. So there's a concept of how many shares you own and then total shares, which is often called shares outstanding. The second concept in shares that are important to understand is common stock versus preferred stock. Common stock is what, in general, you own when you go to the stock market, and in general, you own if you invest in a company. Common is just common. It's what generally people have, nothing special. You may get a dividend, you may not. You may have certain provisions associated with that, which is in the shareholders agreement. You probably have one vote for every share that you have if there needs to be a vote in the company on a specific thing, and that's just a basic common share. But when you go into the fundraising world, you're going to have to learn about preferred shares. Think of a preferred share as having some preference, some advantage over a common shareholder. Now, the easiest, I think, to think of with respect to preferred shares is virtually all preferred shares have the clauses that says if the company were to liquidate, if it were to go out of business, that the preferred shareholders get the cash first. So if they've invested $100,000 and you liquidate the company for $20,000, that $20,000 would first go to the preferred shareholders. Anything left over would go to the common stockholders. But preferred can mean all sorts of things. Preferred can mean that I have the right to be on the board of directors. Preferred can mean I have the right to certain voting privileges. It can mean I have the right to certain information, like quarterly reports and monthly reports and things like that. So it's a number of different things, and we'll talk about the kind of clauses as we go through the class today. But again, preferred, think of it as I got an advantage over common. The other concept of stock that's important in small companies these days, and particularly tech-oriented, but more than just tech, is the notion of a stock option. Okay, now a stock option is not a share of stock. Okay, so we'll go back to our example. I have 1 million shares outstanding, and then I have an additional 100,000 stock options. What an option is exactly what it says. I have the right, I have the option to purchase shares in the future. Okay? So again, a stock option, I have the right to purchase shares in the future. So things go along with that. I have the right to purchase shares at a certain price. So a stock option will often carry a price tag. In a small company, the price tag may be 10 cents a share, or it could be a dollar. Let's just use a dollar as an example. So I have the right to purchase stock at a dollar a share. And I have 100,000 stock options. So that would say that in the future, let's say the price went to $3, $4, $5 a share, I have the right to purchase it for $1, and then, of course, I can sell it for the going market price. If the stock price goes down to 50 cents a share or anything below a dollar, you would, of course, never, what they call, exercise your stock options because there's no reason. Why would you buy a stock at a dollar and sell it for 99 cents or 20 cents on the dollar or whatever? So that's a stock option. Options also carry with them the concept of vesting. They can. They don't have to. A vested option means that in the future, in some time period, those options vest and become active. Let me give an example. So again, I got my 100,000 options, and let's say they vest over 4 years. What that means is every year, 25,000, or one quarter of those, now I'm actually allowed to buy 25,000 shares. In year two, it goes to 50, 375, and finally in year four, I can buy all 100,000. The reason why these vesting periods typically happen in companies is because you're trying to give your employees stock, but you also want them to stay with the company. So the concept is they will stay as an employee to the extent that they can vest more shares the next year and the next year and the next year, assuming, of course, the stock price and the value of the company is going up. So that's the idea of a stock option. It is very common to offer stock options to employees, new employees. It's a great incentive because they have an incentive to make the company more valuable, not just to work there and do their job, and they have an incentive to stay over time. Okay, and lastly, in terms of stock, there are some tax issues, but I'm not going to go into really details of tax today, as far as stock is concerned. So now let's move back to the topic of funding. And again, funding, I mean raising money. Now there are many sources of funding, different places you can get funding. I'm going to talk about each of the sources, and I'm also going to talk about the differences between the sources. Okay. So I'll quickly mention the sources, and then we'll get into some of the differences. So private investors basically is, think of a rich guy, somebody who invests privately. Could be a family member, could be an outside investor. Venture capital, these are companies that are, in essence, investment companies. They raise a lot of money, and then they invest that money in companies, hopefully to get a positive return when the company is worth more money. A third possible source is corporate partners. What that means is a company that invests in your company. For example, my current company, TalkShoe, we have an investor who is one of our or one of our customers, if you will, or I should say one of our partners. He's the partner that provides some of the hardware equipment for our service, so they've done some investing. Government programs, there's a number of programs at the local level, the state level, and the federal level where you can raise money. There's banks, of course, and then my favorite form of funding is called profits, which means you don't have to go outside, you make it yourself. Now, the most important thing that I'm going to talk about now is that money is not created equal. A dollar really is not just a dollar. Okay, it isn't. It carries different things with it depending upon where you get the money. Point one, the people. It matters who specifically you're getting money from. So let's assume people wanted to be on your board of directors as an investor. Well, if they're coming from a venture capital group, they may have knowledge of certain partnerships or other companies. You may like the people, you may not like the people. It's important because that person is going to sit on your board of directors. A private investor, it probably matters, again, who it is. I've had one company I worked for, I raised money about $2 million from about 30 investors, and a few of those investors were kind of pain in the butts. We're calling and trying to get information and give advice, and I really didn't think they knew much about our business. So it mattered who the people were. Corporate partners. Sounds good. Get a company like Google to invest in your company. Well, if Google invests in your company, they're going to look out for Google and then try to steer your company in their direction. And probably a company like Yahoo is not going to be interested in purchasing you. Government. It's the government. They don't bring anything with it. They bring money, and chances are they're not going to be a part of you. So that's kind of good, but there are some local agencies that will, in fact, want to be on your board of directors in addition. Banks, of course, is pretty obvious. Okay, percent ownership, obviously that matters. So when you raise money, you are selling a percent of your company. Don't think of how many shares you're selling. The number of shares is not relevant. The percent of shares matters. So if I have 1 million shares outstanding, and I price it at $1 a share, my company's worth $1 million, and you invest $300,000, you get 300,000 shares, and you own 30% of the company. So obvious, that's how you deal with percent ownership. Certainly the first thing that will cross your mind about percent ownership is you don't want to give up more than half if you don't have to. If you give up less than half of the company, if a major decision has to be made and you own 50%, you can always outvote everyone. And on the other hand, you shouldn't go too crazy about this, because some people say, I don't want to give up anything. I want my whole company. I never want to sell any ownership. I want to own everything. Well, that's great, but you're passing up the opportunity for different people to not only invest, but also potentially be part of your company and work with you. The most important thing to me of the considerations is what I call control considerations. And maybe you're saying to yourself, what do you mean by control? How could an investor have control over me? Let me give you an example. When venture capitalists, and we'll talk a bit more about what venture capitalists basically do in a second, but when they invest in you, very often they have board seats. So let's say there are 5 board members and they have 2 board seats. Well, those 2 board seats have voting rights as a board member. They also can influence you. They cannot approve things, and you really don't want to have a vote 3-2 or something like that. You want everybody to agree so they have some control over you. In addition, it's very common in a venture capital investment for a clause to say, if you sell the company or want to sell the company, we being the venture capitalists, have to approve the sale. Now, it seems pretty reasonable. If somebody's going to buy me for $50 million, it'd be nice if the venture capitalists could have a say. It makes sense. However, what that means in essence is they have veto power. What if they don't want to sell to that particular company? What if they don't think the price is right? They think it's too low, you think it's fine. Well, since they have the provision that says they have to vote yes for a purchase of the company, they in essence have veto power. Okay, so that's the type of control that I'm talking about. The next thing is what I call flexibility for future funding, and maybe I should say that better by saying the ability for them to invest in the future. Now, some types of funding sources have money for the future, some don't. An example, venture capitalists, this is typically, when they invest a dollar in a company, they put a dollar in reserve. They're not saying they're going to give you that money. They're just knowing, based on their averages and the companies they've invested in, chances are, on average, that if they invest a dollar, that same company will need another dollar for them in the future. Now, again, when I'm talking dollars, they might invest $2 million and reserve $2 million on the side. On the other hand, government is the government. A government gives you a small business grant of some kind. In 2 years, if you need money for expansion of your sales force, they're not going to give you money, right? So that's they don't have future. Private investors are mixed. Some private investors tend to want to invest all they're going to invest at the beginning. They trust you. They know you. They're going to want to put their money to work. And 2 years from now, they probably don't have the money. So they're not a good source for future funding. Board seats. Some investors want to be on your board of directors. Some investors demand to be on your board of directors, and they will go so far as to say, I will not give you the money if I'm not on your board of directors. And you might say, well, then fine. Well, you need the money. So board seats, venture capitalists almost always want board seats, or at least some number of board seats. Somebody who invests a large percentage of their money will of the money they're giving you, say you're raising $1 million and they put in $700,000 of that, they're probably going to want to say they want a board seat. And it makes sense for them, right? They want to see what's happening in the company. They just put $700,000 of their own money at stake. The next thing is liquidity and investment horizon. And maybe that sounds a little techie for you in financial terms. But what that means is, when do the people want their money back? Now, you may say to yourself, well, they all want it back tomorrow, right? That's not the case. In a government grant, they may never want the money back. It just is a grant, and you don't have to sell the company at any time. If it's an individual, they probably have a pretty long investment horizon. Most people who invest in companies have enough money that they're investing their discretionary money. They're not investing the funds that they really are putting their kids to school with. So they tend to have a longer horizon, a longer period of time. Venture capitalists, on the other hand, have a medium horizon. They typically want to get their money back within 5 to 7 years, with a return on top of that. And why does this matter? Well, it matters because if you're in year five and you want to invest more money, and you don't want to be profitable because you want to invest more and grow the company and sell it 5 years later, a venture capitalist might say, well, wait a minute, I want out. I don't want to be a part of this. And that can be, of course, potentially an issue. Reporting requirements sounds like no big deal, right? You give people financial statements. First of all, doing financial statements every month is a pain in the butt, okay? Second of all, when they ask for information, you generally have to give it to them. A third example is the government. The government usually has some kind of reporting where you have to, fill out forms every month or every quarter or every year to tell them about the status of your business and what you're doing with their money and things like that. So you have to always look into reporting requirements. Okay. The next topic I'm going to talk about is venture capital. I've mentioned the word venture capital many times in this class today and probably in other classes. And venture capital is perhaps the most interesting form of funding. It's also the source that gets a lot of press these days because most startup technology companies, medical companies, things like that, are funded by venture capitalists. Okay, so here's the basic deal. A venture capitalist goes and raises money. Let's say they go and raise $100 million. They raise that typically from company pension funds. That's the biggest source. The government may want to invest in venture capitalists and potentially very wealthy individuals. A lot of venture capital funds, in fact, are started by wealthy individuals who may put in literally $30, $40, $50 million of their own money and then go raise additional money. Okay, so they raise money. Now it's like any investment. It's like a mutual fund. okay, except this mutual fund or this venture capital fund invests in startup companies. They don't invest in IBM and Cisco and Bell companies. They invest in startup companies. So a fund, say, of $100 million may want to look at about 10 companies they want to invest in. Let's assume on average they want to give the company $10 million. I'm just using round numbers again. Now, remember I talked about the concept of partnerships, general partners and limited partners in my last class. The VCs, the venture capitalists, are general partners. They run the fund. They are on the board of directors. They make the decisions. They help the company, things like that. And they are liable for that if something were to go wrong. The limited partners, the guys who put up the $100 million, it's just an investment. It's like if you invest in a mutual fund and that mutual fund hurts somebody, they're not going to come after you, right? They're going to go after the fund itself. Okay, so they invested. A typical life of a venture capital fund is 10 years. It just is 10 years. I mean, there's different lengths, of course, but in general, the vast majority are 10-year funds. What that says is I'm going to take that $100 million as a VC, and I've got 10 years to return it back to you as an investment, hopefully with a high rate of return. So if you think about it, I'm probably going to spend the first 1 to 3 years investing the money in companies, and then I'm going to want to get a return and hopefully sell those companies or take them public by the time the 10 years is up. So that's why when I said before they have a medium-term horizon, they typically want to get their money back in that 5 to 7 year period. Now, venture capital funds are different in terms of their focus. Some focus on different stage companies. So a seed stage company means literally at the very beginning of companies. A startup phase would be considered once you have the team together and maybe you've already raised a little money, you've gotten started. A growth stage would be you've already got customers, you just want to grow the business and get more and more customers. And what's called a mezzanine fund financing is the kind of financing that comes in the middle, hence the word mezzanine, typically right before you were to go do an IPO or a public offering. Maybe a year before or something like that. Others specialize in industries, and this is very important. A venture capitalist looks at his portfolio of companies and says, okay, here's the deal. I want to invest, let's say I'm a telecommunications fund, so that's the kind of companies I invest in. Well, I don't want to put all of it into equipment, so I want to invest some of it into local area network equipment, some into long-distance equipment, some into telephone company services, some into fiber, optics, etc. And they then go out and try to find what they believe are the best one or two companies in each area. Of course, they're not going to fund two companies that are direct competitors. So if you go to a venture capitalist and you're trying to go to a telecom guy and sell him on the concept of a media company, and this happened to me in the past, it was kind of telecom, but fundamentally it was a video over the internet, so it was media. We got a lot of no's because they said, we just don't do media companies. So if you find yourself with a venture capitalist having to explain what you do in the industry, chances are you're not going to be able to raise money from them. Okay, so they invest, as I said, so much per year, and again, they get their money back. They buy a piece of companies. They typically are on the board of directors. Let me give you an example of some math. So basically, assuming a venture capitalist, for example, wants to get a rate of return of about, say, 30 to 50% per year. That probably sounds high, but think of the risk-reward trade-off. So the stock market earns in the neighborhood over the past, whatever it is, 50 years or so, it's earned approximately 14% rate of return. So if I'm going to invest in a venture capital fund, it better give me better than the stock market, or I'll just put my money in the stock market, because the stock market's not going to go to zero, where a venture capital fund could easily go to zero if their investments in startups don't pan out. So they want a rate of return, again, 20, 25, 30, 35, depending upon the market conditions. So a typical $100 million fund that had a rate of return of 30% a year actually would have to make $630 million to make the investors happy. By the way, people ask often, how do venture capitalists make their money? Well, it turns out, let's take that example, the way they make $630, they get 20% of the upside. So the upside is I gave you $100 million, you turned it into $630 million, so I get 20% of $530 million. Okay, of the part I earned you, I get 20%. That's a lot of money. Okay, in that case, they just made somewhere in the neighborhood of $100 million. And that's why venture capitalists, the successful ones, are some of the most wealthy people in the country. And then they typically say, okay, I'm going to want to, you know, one of those companies might do a public offering where I'll make a pile of money. One of them might do investing where I'm kind of a break even, and one might do investing where it's a buyout situation. Somebody out there asked a question about angel investors. And just give me 1 minute and I'll talk about angel investors. So again, their idea is they want so much rate of return, they have money and they want to invest. Now, here's something to be concerned with. If they're a $100 million fund, they don't want to invest in 100 companies. That'll drive them crazy. So they may want to invest in 10 to 15. What that says is the average deal they want to do is, say, $7 to $10 million. Well, you want to raise $1 million. They're not, forget it, don't go to a venture capitalist. They don't want to give you $1 million. They're either going to talk you into more money, which means they're going to take a higher percentage of your company, or they're going to end up not investing. The only exception to that is if it's a seed venture capital fund where they literally don't mind giving, say, $1 million, but that is pretty rare. Because, again, if you have $100 million to invest, putting it out in chunks of a half a million, there's no way that's going to work for you. Okay, let's get to the question about angel investors. Basically, angel investors come from heaven, hence the term angel investors. So they drop out of the sky, and these are wealthy individuals. So anybody who's a wealthy individual, be it your parents, be it your friends, be it a business associate, and gives you money is called, in parlance, an angel investor. A couple of things to know about angel investors. First of all, it matters who you get the money from, as I said before, because if it's a guy who is kind of a pain, or maybe it's a family member. I knew one company where it was an older brother, was an investor, and was driving the guy crazy because, you know, older brothers always think their younger brothers don't know what they're doing. But let's assume that you got some good angel investors, and you do respect them. You do not want to take money from just anybody. And for the following reason. There's something called an accredited investor. And an accredited investor is defined fundamentally as someone who has enough money and is sophisticated enough to make an investment in a company that is a high-risk investment. Today, the threshold is approximately $1 million in net worth. Net worth is all of your assets. So you have to have at least $1 million. Now, that rules out a lot of people, but here's why you don't want to take it from people with less than if you don't have to. If I only have $50,000 in the bank and I give you 20 of it and you lose it all, you lost 40% of my net worth, and I'm not an accredited investor, it's actually pretty easy for me to come at you as a from a legal standpoint, and claim that I didn't know everything, this wasn't the investment I thought, and any other provisions that they can possibly make up to somehow sue you and get some money out of you. Okay, accredited investors, of course, can sue. Anybody can sue anybody. But accredited investors basically are saying, I know enough that if I lose money on this deal, I lose it. And that's just the way it is. Okay, so... And I've invested in companies, and I've lost 100% of the money as an accredited investor, and that's the way it is. So that's kind of a little overview in terms of angel investing. Let's talk about some of the other sources. Banks is another one, and this falls under the heading of debt financing. So if you think of debt financing, you should think about basically loans, okay? So a loan is something that there's a principal, which is that I'm borrowing $100,000 and there's a interest rate, let's say 10%. So basically I get $100,000 of your money in a bank or really any institution. In fact, an angel investor can give you debt, frankly. Pretty rare, but it can happen. Here's $100,000, you owe me 10% a year. So you keep my $100,000, okay, and you owe me 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, and at some period of time you repay the principal or the 100,000 that you borrowed. If you know about the stock market and the bond market, debt is also a bond. A bond is fundamentally a loan. So when you think of debt financing, think of loans. Now, getting money from a bank is not trivial as a startup company. In general, you will have to act as an individual. And what I mean by that is if you have a company, whether it's high-tech or whether it's a restaurant, and you want to raise $100,000, they are probably going to want as collateral your house, or if not your house, then some of your assets. Okay? So they're going to pierce through the company, even if you're a corporation, and say, I want something as collateral. So you have to think about that because now you're putting up not only you're putting up your own money. I mean, think about that. Banks don't want to take risk. Banks hate risk. They're paid to not have risk. I mean, a bank does one thing, all right? It takes your money and it gives you whatever, 5% a year on your money in the form of a CD or a savings account or whatever. It turns around and loans it at 7% and they make 2%. That's all a bank is. They make a small percentage over a ton of money. So they don't like risk. But if they see that you're venture might be profitable, and then you'll borrow more money and get a line of credit and various things, you may be a good customer for them, so they may be interested in giving you debt financing. There are some banks that are special banks. The most notable name is Silicon Valley Bank. They invest in companies who are risky ventures, and they do take debt financing. So you're saying, well, why the heck would they do that? Well, one thing is they do get a little bit higher rate of return on their money. But the second thing is they're saying, you're a risky entity, so I want something more than debt. I want some equity. I want some stock in addition to the debt. Generally, they'll take it in the form of a warrant, which is basically the same as an option. So at a certain period, they get options in addition to their debt. Now, again, why the heck would they do this? Banks don't want to do this. Well, Silicon Valley Bank and others are hooked up with venture capitalists. They invest along with a venture capitalist. So a venture guy might put in $2 million in your company and then take a $500,000 loan from Silicon Valley Bank. And what they're doing, in essence, is trusting the venture capitalist and saying, okay, if you're going to invest in this, you must think it's a good investment. I'll invest along with you. Okay, so but they're special banks. That doesn't happen often. Another thing that you'll want to know about is something called a bridge loan. And a bridge loan fundamentally, again, think of the concept of a bridge, is if I reach a point where I don't have much money. I mean, literally, I don't have much money. I might not even be able to make payroll this month or next month. But I know I can raise the money. It's just going to take me 6 months to raise that money. I just don't have a source right now, but the company's doing well and things like that. You will do a bridge loan. And a bridge loan is generally a short-term loan, let's say $500,000, from today, whatever today is, the end of January until the end of June. You repay that $500,000. You give me a good interest rate, generally about 10%. Nobody's trying to screw anybody here. It's just give me a reasonable interest rate. And then I get my money back, and in exchange for that bridge loan, I get, again, some of these warrants or options in the company. Venture guys can also provide bridge loans. They're giving you money until such time as you raise additional venture capital money. Angels can give you, anybody can give you a bridge loan, and it's just a term used to mean a short term from sort of here to there in a company. Okay, so again, let's kind of compare the different sources. And I talked about horizon before. That means when they want their money back. A venture capitalist wants it back in the short to medium term. A private investor, I said, tends to be a little longer term. A corporate investment will be longer term because they're thinking strategic. And government funding is either long term or never. They may never want their money back. Let me just spend a second on government financing. I didn't spend too much time. When I talk about government financing, typically in every city, every decent-sized city in the country, there are agencies. Okay, they go by various names. There's one here in Pittsburgh called Innovation Works, and they have raised money from the state of Pennsylvania, and their job basically is economic development. And there may be other SBSSA loans, other kinds of things like that. You basically apply. They give you small amounts of money. $20,000, $50,000, $100,000. InnovationWorks actually gives it up to $300,000. And you apply, like you would apply anywhere. They're going to want to see your business plan. They're going to want to talk to you. They're going to want references, all that sorts of stuff. And then they will give you it. What they're mostly concerned about is the economic development of their city, and they're trying to promote small companies that will, of course, grow to be big and hire lots of people and make generate lots of tax revenues. Some of them these days actually take stock in your company. Others just give you the money as a grant. It depends. So you want to look locally, and again, it's generally not a lot of money, but it's a good way to get you started. Maybe you get started, you use $50,000, $100,000, you hire a couple guys, you get your product started, you get your business plan written, then you go and raise money, a little more money. Okay, a time to close is another variable to think about, and that what I mean by that is if I today decide I want money, how long is it going to take for me to get that money in the bank? Okay, a private investor is very, very short term. If you convince a guy, a business partner or whatever, to invest in your company, they generally are making the decision because of you. They know you. Of course, they like your concept also and your idea. And they'll generally, they don't have to go through this big due diligence process and an analysis and call references and all customers and all this stuff. They will typically invest the money pretty fast, literally in the matter of weeks. Government is kind of in the medium to long term. You know, you have to fill out applications. There's generally a process. Approval process may take a few months. It may take even longer to get your cash, things like that. Venture capitalists actually take quite a while. And a venture guy will tell you sometimes, hey, I can invest in 2 months. And it is true back in the late 1990s, in the heyday of startup companies, that VCs were investing literally in a matter of 30 days because the market was so hot. There was so many people trying to get investing in these companies that they just basically threw money at companies, and most of them made incredible amounts of money. But they are investment guys. These are bankers of a sort. These are investment banker kind of guys. They are paid to be conservative. They're not paid to take crazy risks, even though they're startup companies. They're paid to minimize their risk and get a good return. So they, as a fiduciary responsibility, as a finance person to their limited partners who invested, they're going to do everything you could possibly think of. They're going to read your business plan. They're going to get a presentation, probably 2 or 3 presentations from you. They're going to check your references from past jobs. They're going to check references of other people in the company. They're going to want to talk to potential customers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Then, to top it all off, you're going to want to negotiate probably 2 months of legal negotiations to get the document completed. And by the way, VCs always have this clause, believe it or not, in a venture capital deal, which says you pay for my legal fees. A legal fees to do a venture capital deal can easily total $40,000 or $50,000 on both ends. And what they're saying is, here's my million I'm going to invest in you, but I want you to pay the legal costs that I just incurred to invest the money. And it sounds absurd, right? I mean, they're the investors. They should pay their own legal costs. So they negotiate forever until they get what they want, and then you have to pay their legal costs. Now, of course, there's some caps and things like that, but it can add up to considerable money. And remember, they've got you in the sense that they're negotiating with you. So they know how much cash you have. Sales and partnerships. What I mean by that is, to what extent can these sources bring you revenues? Well, venture capitalists are pretty low. They tend not to know people who will buy your stuff, but they're very high on partnerships because they deal with CFOs, they deal with CEOs and ex-CEOs of companies. So these are the kind of people who your company may want to partner with. Partner meaning distribute your product, sell your product, market your product, do a joint development product, etc. Private people are low in both partnerships and sales. Corporations are high in both. Partnerships, because you can partner with them, and sales, because they'll buy something, most likely. Government, again, nothing to do with sales or partnerships. They don't really have any connections, if you will. And then, as I said, another variable is how many funds do they have. VCs are very high. They reserve money for you. And the other sources, like private and government, are low. Corporations are in the middle because if they have to, they'll certainly invest some money to bail you out. They don't want their investments to go down the tubes. Okay, so that's kind of overview and some with some pretty good detail in terms of various sources of funding and how they compare. Let's look at a couple of other sources really briefly. Accounts payable. Accounts payable in accounting speak says that's what you owe people. Okay, so you bought a computer, you owe somebody $3,000. That's an accounts payable. You haven't paid it yet. Well, you can raise money from accounts payable. How you do that is you don't pay your bills, okay, or you don't pay them on time, or you stretch them out. So basically, you're raising cash, in essence, by getting equipment or getting furniture or whatever and just not paying it off right away. Okay, so that's a source of cash, if you will, short-term cash. Accounts receivable is the other end of the spectrum. Accounts receivable says that I've sold something, so let's say I sold $50,000 worth of my product, but I haven't been paid yet. So that's the bad news, right? I don't have it. So how do I raise money on accounts receivable? Banks like to invest and loan money off of accounts receivable. So if you can show them that your customers, 99% of your customers pay their bills over a 45-day period, then they'll look at the next 45 days and say, okay, I'm willing to give you a loan up to that kind of amount based on accounts receivable. And in essence, the accounts receivable is their collateral. So if you go out of business, those guys who still have to pay their bills, they get the money. Okay, so it's a pretty working capital is a kind of a loan that you get typically from a bank, which is just think of it as a bank account that you can kind of draw up and down as you want over time. Lease financing, common to lease equipment. One of the most common things is to lease computer equipment, say from a company like Dell. One thing I should tell you about that is it's important for a company to establish credit to borrow off of. And that probably doesn't make sense yet, so just give me a second. You as an individual, when you go for a credit card or to borrow or anything like that, they look at your credit history. That means, have you paid your bills over time? And there are credit reports and all that sort of thing. Well, a company has to have a credit history. Well, you're only 6 months old. How can you have a credit history? You can't. So literally, Dell may be sending you a piece of literature in the mail today saying, offering you to lease up to $10,000 worth of home office computers, but you as a company, they won't give that same lease to because you don't have established credit. So often you may literally have to sign your personal over to the leases. Basically what it means is go out and get a lease, pay it off, and then you'll establish credit for future leases. And there are leasing companies that will act as intermediaries between the equipment vendor and between you, and they may give you slightly higher rates, so they're making a little more money, but that's a good way to establish credit. Vendor financing is common. It was very common in the late 90s when a company wanted to become an internet service provider. The big equipment vendors like Cisco and Lucent would give them equipment and then not expect payment for it for a while. So that's in essence vendor financing because they're giving you the stuff without wanting the money. Some considerations about that. I said accounts payable, you don't pay your bills. Well, that's nice, but if you don't pay your bills, you get everybody mad at you, and that's not a good idea. And they may even report you, which is worse for your credit history. So there's, generally, if you owe somebody $50,000, yeah, I'll give you $20 now and $20 later and this sort of thing. The other thing is, remember, you can't get something for nothing, so you may be giving up, personal credit to fund computers or to fund office furniture or things like that. Okay, so those are, again, some other sources. Basically, to conclude, I want to talk about the kind of observations that I'd make overall. And this is, you know, we talked about investment, we talked about all this stuff, but one question you might be saying is, well, why the heck would people invest in my company? All right? It's not easy. You're going to get told no most of the time. But think about it. They're going to invest for the same reasons that you'd invest in a company or that you think you have a good idea. They're going to invest in the people. They either know you, they know people who know you, you have a track record, your background. And remember, as I said in previous classes, it's the people, stupid. They're going to invest in people first and foremost. Of course, they will invest in your idea if they think it's a good one. They'll invest in your business, meaning the ability to make profits and have strong financials over time. And they'll also invest because maybe they think it's just a good deal. So they think that they can get a pretty, the company will only be worth $1 million and I'll buy 300,000 and get 30%. Gee, $1 million is not a very high valuation. I think it's a good deal. Same company, everything being the same, people, everything else. And basically what happens is they won't invest because they're only going to get 10% of a deal that is valued at $10 million. Okay? The other thing, quite honestly, that I found is there's the bandwagon effect is why people invest, and that is if you invest, I'll invest. And I've presented to a number of angel investors in these clubs, and, you know, if there's 20 guys in a room, one time I got about 10 of them to invest, kind of one invested, the other guy invested, the other guy invested, things like that. It also happens with venture capitalists. If venture capitalists invest, it's pretty common that other venture capitalists will want to invest because they tend to know each other, because they've invested in previous deals and things like that. Okay, so again, that's pretty much it for today. And stay tuned for future lectures. In general, I give these classes between 12 and 2 o'clock. On Fridays, check the schedule on TalkShoe.com because I give them at different times, depending upon my availability. Check out my website, which is www.TalkShoe.com/Professor Giuliano, J-U-L-I-A-N-O. There are PowerPoint lecture slides. There are some handouts, documents, things like that that I use in teaching my course while at Carnegie Mellon. And again, this is a course that parallels my course at Carnegie Mellon that I'm teaching this semester and I've taught for the past 6 years. All right, well, that's it for today, and I will hopefully see you on a future class. This is unique in the sense of it's an online internet class, but also you can, of course, listen to the recordings. If you want to find out some more details about the course, go to back to Episode 1 and check out Episode 1, which has information about my background and course materials and things like that. So until next time, this is Mark signing off.